Gabby wanted to express her disappointment, excuse me, for not being able to come. And I'm sure that if she would be here, you would have a much, much better presentation than I'm able to give to you. But I will do my best to cover the work that was done. If you were here for my presentation, you saw the decline in number of cases of leishmaniasis out of Iraq.
These six flies, we just arrange the cells in five distinct groups, and we have the first group, we have a lot of mitochondria, it's the cell we show cell type 1, and large amount of the endoplasmatic reticulum. The cell type 2, we have a very big activity on these cells. The cell type 3, we have a very large amount of the lucent points and few mitochondria. It's showing a big activity in these cells. And type 5, we have a very electron dense cytoplasm. For these, we just put in five different types, just looking the morphology. But what we find is we have these five types for Mygone, just two types for Lutzomyia longipalpis, and three types of the cells from the phlebotomus on the wart. In conclusion, we demonstrated that the sandfly salivar glands are constituted for a relatively small number of the cells according with their ultrastructure in lectin binding, and we characterized these in five different populations. In three different species, sandflies tested were found five distinct cells, and we need to do more studies for understand the whole of these different type of cells. And in longipalpis, we have demonstrated present subpopulations for Maxagillum, and could be we have some subpopulations as was showed for Mygone, but we have no idea what substances these cells are producing. And such studies help to understand details of the secretion of the salivary components. And thanks from my lab in Brazil, Paulo, Luciana, and Jeannie, and from the Sandflies Worldwide, from Peter Wolf Labs and Vera.
We have some time for questions. Any questions here? One in the back.
Could be. I can't do a markation with osmium and show if just a lip wrapped. I can do this. Could be. Maxagilla, it's a. No.
We collected our sandflies and we collected our samples from so you can see the four places, the area called F1 star, that's Kfar Adamim. We collected two sites there. Kfar Adamim in fact is a tropica site. There's lots of papatazi in the houses, but they're not actually the vector. We collected from two areas in the Jordan River, one in the spring and one in the late summer, which we call the arid area, and I'll try and show you a photograph of that, and one in an oasis called Niota Kikar, which is a small Leishmania site with lots of papatazi. We also collected one way up in the north. It's another tropical site near the Sea of Galilee, but I'm not going to talk about that site too much. It's too much data for one thing. So these sites vary. The south of the Dead Sea, it's very low. It's below sea level. It's about 340 meters below sea level. Very hot, 38 degrees. And the important thing is that the reservoir there, which is San Momis, only about 10% are infected. Only about 10% are infected. In the Gilgal, in the Jordan Valley area, we get up to about 90% infected. And you can see the maximum temperature in the spring, it's about 28 degrees. In the summer, it can be as high as 42. And then this other side, the Kfar Dumim site, that's above sea level, and that's, there's no major there at all. Okay? Now, the reason that we sort of began to worry about this is, as Phil was saying earlier, suddenly we had no Leishmania in our sandflies. And that happened about 1996, and we desperately looked around for other sources of sandflies. It just continued to go down and down and down. And we had the feeling that too much sugar was one of the problems. So we took this colony from Kfar Dumim, which it was only about 10% susceptible to Leishmania. We starved them for 5 to 6 days, and then we fed them on blood, allowed them to oviposit, and then we infected the F1 generation. And amazed, we found, was that 64 to 86% were suddenly infected when the original colony only had 10%. So this got us very excited. Well, some of us got excited. And so we began to look at some of the data we'd been collecting for some time. And when you go to the oasis site, that's the one in the south of the Dead Sea, nearly every single sandfly was, in fact, anthrone positive. Anthrones are tested for sugar, they were all positive. In the arid site in the Jordan Valley, only about 25% of them were infected. Then we looked for starch inside the sandflies from the Jordan Valley, and we found many, many of the femurs had little starch granules inside them. And then so we compared what we had with the infected, so that the oasis site, 25% were infected, the papatazi this time, about 75 to 80% in the arid site. The SARV ones, which is just a lab test, was about 50, 60, sometimes 70%. And if you just sugar fed your flies, just ordinary sucrose, you got really lousy results in our lab. And in fact, even the number of promastigotes you get in those flies varied. In the arid site, it was much higher than anywhere else. In the oasis site, they were absolutely hopeless. Okay, if you don't know very much about plants, they have lots of sugar in them. Some in the phloem is mainly sucrose. The extra floral nectars contain glucose and fructose and sucrose. The honeydews from the hemipterans, very complex, lots and lots of sugars in there. And some plant carbohydrates, their sugar polymers, again, fairly from arabinose all the way through to starch. This is the Phlebotomus papatazi on caper. Caper plants are very common in the Jordan Valley. And they seem to crawl up looking and looking and looking and looking, and then suddenly, even though they've got very, very light proboscis, they seem to be able to probe inside there. Fortunately, somebody put a finger on the original slide, and this is what I'm left with. But there we go. These are extra floral nectaries. I don't know as entomologists you know anything about extra floral nectaries, but we discovered these recently as being a great source of sugar. Here, this Ricinus communis, the castor oil bean. You can see these where the arrows are. Oh, you can't see that, can you? Well, you can see the arrows. You can see arrows. And we found that this is one of the common sources of sugar in the field for sandflies. This is the other source, and I stole these from the ARS. I hope they'll forgive me. I did give them credit. This is the mealybug, the manna mealybug, which is very common, and Tamarix jordanus is very common in the Jordan Valley, all on both sides of the Dead Sea area, and that's very very heavy sugar source for a lot of sandflies. And the other one, Icteropurchusi, that's a scaly insect, also leaves lots of sugar. If you try and take like a gorse bush, if it has no Icteropurchusi on it, the sandflies won't feed. You can get quite a few of them will feed if it has the honeydew from the percheri. I also found this, I don't know who Phil Pelletri is, but he did a lovely job of showing us just honeydew left on a leaf by an insect. Okay, this is where Kfar Damim is. It's a village about 15 kilometers east of Jerusalem. That's Jerusalem in the background. And this is the oasis site. You can see it's very rich, lots of date palms. There's a little village there. You can actually put out your traps, go back to the village, you know, have a few beers, and then first thing in the morning collect your insects. Very popular for date palms there. There's Jordan in the background with the Dead Sea. Okay, this is what the real, what we call our arid site. In the spring it's quite green. That's the one on the left. Is it on the left for you? Yeah, it's on the left for you. And it, by the summer, there's nothing there. That's a Tamarix Jordanus tree in the background in the summer. Dry, almost no greenery around at all. And this is Semomis abyssus. We've been all talking about this. Is it actually in its natural habitat, the little holes. My wife made this slide for me, and I think it's rather gorgeous. In and out of the holes, they're only diurnally, they only come out in the daytime, so the sandflies feed at them on the nighttime. This is Atropix halimus. It's the most important place to find Semomis usually, but it's under these bushes, and the sandflies actually feed on it. How do I know this? Because we took sandflies, fed them only on Atropix, and you can see the little, can I do it gently? I can't. You can see the little grains, you can see those? Where the yellow arrow is, that's starch grains inside the gut. And what you can also find sometimes is actual pieces of cellulose, which you can stain with fluorescent brightener, inside the gut of the sandfly, and that's that little white thing on the left. Under phase on the right, you can't see anything. Under the left, you can see with the yellow arrow, the white. I don't want to use the pointer because I have a feeling I'll just move on too fast. Okay, so what did we do? We took four, I'm going to talk about the four different groups. The ones from the oasis, the ones from, let's say, the end of summer, which we're calling the very arid area, ones in the spring that Marcella might be interested in, and this is starved group, okay? The first thing we noticed was that the arid females were much heavier than any of the other sandflies, much, much heavier than any of the other sandflies, which was why they were heavy, why they were bigger. They maintained it over a two-year period. They always remained higher. We had actually took, every 2 months, we took a group of flies and we froze them down so that we could compare them all at the same time. So over a two-year period, basically, we looked at all these different samples. So they were heavier than anything else. These are the sugars that we tried to look at. It's a long list. I don't really want to go through every single one of them, but these are all the sugars. You can see them there, and I believe it's been recorded, so you can go back over it afterwards. We looked at some what we call metabolic enzymes, the chitinases, which is something we described a very long time ago, about 20 years ago now, I think. And the reason that we looked at guts rather than looking, sorry, the reason we looked at homogenates, whole body homogenates, rather than just actual guts, was because we had to do something like 10,000 sandflies altogether. And dissecting out guts over 10,000 sandflies was like almost impossibility for us. So we compared the results of the guts and we found we were just losing activity. We just couldn't do it fast enough, just two of us. So we decided to go for the whole homogenates instead. But all these enzymes were present in the guts. I'm going to need a pointer now. It's going to get difficult. Okay. So you could see these are the four sort of what we call the glucosidase enzymes. And you can see immediately that the yellow, which is the arid sandflies, I've tried to color code them so it make it easier for you. The yellow for arid, all right? You can see immediately that that's much, much higher than in the oasis, in the oasis group. Dare I use it? We really need a pointer, mate. Don't think I'm going to use it. Oh, yes, okay. It's come up. So you can see it's much, much higher. What I feared, okay. I'm almost going to stand out there and do it. So the glucoside, big differences. And then you look at sucrase and these starved flies, which came from this long, like 4 or 5 years only before sucrase, they seem to have much more sucrase than any of the other flies. Amylase, very much the same in the female flies, very, very little difference. And amylase, as you know, is the enzyme for starch. And maltase, which almost all the same for all the females. Males, quite a bit of variation in the males, but the basic picture was that the starved ones were very high in glucosidase and the Jordan Valley ones of males are very high in sucrase. I don't know why these are, but they're very specific differences. They are statistically different as well. Big variations. This is what one of our biggest problems is. Some of the groups, they stay consistent and tight over a year period. says every 2 months taking 100, 200 flies each time and estimating them, the groups stayed the same. But the Jordan Valley flies, very variable over a whole year's period. But again, they were statistically much higher than in the other groups. The chitinase activity, which is one of the big contentions, do the flies use the chitinase to break down the pleiotrophic membrane and let the and if they don't have any chitinase, then do the leishmania actually help the sandfly break down? What we found was very interesting. The Neotachycar, the oasis fly, which are very poor vectors or very poor transmitters of leishmania, have very high N-acetyl beta hexaminase and very high chitinases, and against the Jordan Valley arid ones had virtually little, very very little of these enzymes. It's as if the leishmania, which is the best vectors, have to help the sandfly, and they break the pleiotrophic membrane at the front, and therefore they're able to escape towards the proboscis. And the ones which are lousy vectors are in fact ones that have very much too much chitinase for the leishmania. The metabolic enzymes, you know, they're not very important to us today, I don't think. Big enzyme variation, again, I'm showing you that the Jordan Valley flies and much more variation than in the other flies. Big changes when you feed them on a sugar meal. And the reason that this took us so long was because you feed flies or each of the different groups on sugar meals at the same time. Glucosinase goes down, sucrase goes up. Amylase stays about the same, maltase stays about the same. And some, for some variations, we just can't explain why. For instance, on the alpha fucosidase, the female goes down by 60% and the male goes up. If anybody's got an explanation for that, I'd be only happy to hear it. But these are repeat after repeat after repeat, and always you get the same result. So there's tremendous variation between these four different groups. The N-acetylated enzymes, again, we have hexaminase goes up after a sugar meal in most of the species, but not all of them, and the N-acetylgalactosaminidase goes down. Some people question whether there was any difference between alpha-glucosidase, sucrase, and maltase. I'm not really an enzymologist. I do this because I'm interested in sandflies and leishmania, and so we decided to do the proper job, which was do the KM, and we found immediately that the alpha-glucosidase, the sucrase, and the maltase were very different on the KMs, and even their pHs are different, where they maximize on the pH. Sucrase is about 4.8, maltase shifts a bit, and alpha-glucose even more towards the alkaline level. We try to use enzymes to inhibit these sugars because it's the only way to know whether they're really functioning properly or not. And I have to explain that there are three types of inhibitors. There's the constant inhibition, that's the blue triangle, the dose-dependent one, which goes up, and then there's enzyme activation. Sometimes you get enzyme activation. So just some examples we found, for instance, for alpha-glucosidase, you get a very nice inhibition with a substance called erythritol, which is a sort of a synthetic glucose. Glucose, again, that does a nice job in sucrase. Against inositols, galactose, and lactose, hardly had any effect at all. Alpha-manosidase, we actually saw differences between the four groups with this, and quite extraordinarily, the arid flies, after a very small amount of mannos was immediately inhibited at the 75% level, we kept on adding more mannos, made absolutely no difference, and the others sort of gave us the nice properly dependent sign. Allosamidine is an inhibitor for chitinase, it's very important, it's basically the only one that anyone ever uses, and we find in fact that it did a wonderful job inhibiting the chitotriosidases, but hardly anything on the chitinases. And again, we did what the enzymologists insist we do, the VX and the KM, and the two very different enzymes. So there were significant differences between the arid and the oasis groups, between 10 and 17 of the females and 8 and 17 for the spring and 9 and 17 for the starved. The males weren't quite as different, but when I say significant differences, they really are p equals 0.005 over the numbers we use, because we use very large numbers. So the arid group is a totally different group. It's a wonderful vector, and it has totally different sugar amounts than anything else has. So our conclusions really were that the P. papatazi have a wide repertoire of functioning glycosidases. They vary according to the habitat. These glycosides are inhibited by the appropriate saccharides, and a whole family of chitinoses are expressed and fully functional in the sandflies. Thank you for your attention.
We have time for some questions. After questions, we'll take a break. You have a question?
I have a question.
Okay. So speak into the mic and repeat your questions.
Repeat please. The question.
Oh, this is great, Jim. I have a question in regards to the chitinase in the Jordan Valley versus, I guess, the
oasis. The oasis, yeah.
So the analysis for the catalytic activity was done in whole gut.
Absolutely. So whole homo-